From the basement studios of the Atlantic Voice, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion. This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
This is part two of our special National Recording Registry episode, where we are discussing the Library of Congress and all the recordings that they are stashing away for immortality. And I will say this, that between this episode and the last episode, I did say at the beginning of the last episode that these would be entertaining, but more importantly, educational episodes. I do want to say that between the last episode and this episode, people have said to me how educated they were by our last episode.
And how educated have they said they were? Not very?
Well, very much so. So there you go.
We talked a bunch about, and for anybody who hasn't listened to it, you should go back and listen to it, all about what the National Recording Registry is, and the various things that are in there, the categorizations, how they get picked, all that sort of stuff that would give you the foundation for things.
You know, I did have a thought before we dive into the music segment. And last week, I remember we used the term Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
I do think of the National Recording Registry similar to like a time capsule. You know, they always do those big things where they throw all kinds of stuff in a box and stick it in the ground, and then in 100 years, someone will dig it up and they'll find artifacts from the year 2013 and this sort of stuff. I do think of this as, again, if you were to beam all this stuff into outer space and aliens would hear it, they would get a sense of who we are. That's how I think of it.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of in my mind what's making the cut.
Well, I'm going to disagree only in that typically when you do a time capsule, and this may have just been the choice, I think you probably mean.
But you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I know what you're
like
trying to say.
But
the time capsule, you literally would put the things in of that era, like you'd put in the newspaper today, you would not have spent any time evaluating. Like you could do something that said, oh, listen, this is what we think is representative of our culture today by putting in the songs from this year. But the more importantly here is, because what becomes very important about a lot of this music is, what does it end up causing to happen? You know, what is people's reaction to it? What happens to that song over time? How do people go, oh, is that great? Is that bad? Does it influence what they do? You know, does it change the nature of music or things like that? And we talked a little bit about it in the comedy context last time. But that's their historical significance. You need some time to digest. And so that's why I think of it as more of a Hall of Fame. Like, there's got to be a certain amount of distance. And people have mentioned this. I'm stealing an idea that's been mentioned by Bill Simmons from Grantland and Sports Guy Fame.
Okay.
He's talked about movies. If rather than do Academy Awards then, what we did is we waited 5 years, and then you said, okay, when we look back 5 years ago, which one of those movies was the greatest? And you'd have a very different answer because at the time when you're in the movie kind of thing. So we could do both. That would be another idea I'd like to do, the quickie short term. But what this I think of this being is we're looking back at history. Doesn't have to be deep history, but maybe a few years ago history, and look what kind of recordings have had significance overall for the National Recording Registry. But then now we're getting into music, which is a little bit different than the other ones because I now think we could have some debates over, was JFK's speech more important than FDR's fireside chats compared to these other things and stuff like that, and sort of make fun of it all. But when it comes to music, it's really a lot of his taste. You know,
well, I know how you break the tie there.
How's that?
Well, in Pearl Harbor, the movie, Roosevelt is played by John Voight. Kennedy was played by Martin Sheen. I think Martin Sheen is a greater actor than John Voight. So Kennedy's thing is more important.
All right, well, that's
how you've done it.
That's
if it all
fair,
comes back
fair
to
enough
movies,
reason.
That's how we're doing it.
It's good with me. But like when it comes to the music type of things, we can sit here and we can. I think there'll be a couple of songs that we'll say, we don't think that merits it. You know, it is just not that historically significant, even if somebody liked it. And on the other hand, there's definitely going to be music that we could say, you know, even our amateur selves could say, you know what, this is a very important album. They have not gotten around to listing in here, and we can talk about those things.
And that's the thing, in all seriousness, about some of the spoken word. I was quite critical last episode of some things that I felt really weren't that important in terms of, yeah, the guy said one great line, but other than that, it was just a speech, you know, whatever. With all that recorded stuff, you do have the weight, the gravitas of history attached to it. So that does elevate what might be a pretty bland, Do you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Like, oh, well, that's what so-and-so said the day. Like, you'd mentioned in the last episode about, you know, there's recordings of reporters from the D-Day landings.
Sure.
Now, I don't think anything that they said was important, but it was the fact that it's a recording of them covering the D-Day landings that's the significant thing. Music, on the other hand, there's no historical significance. This is all now down to...
Well, there might be some, but mostly, you know, it's art.
It's art, and then it all comes down to opinions.
Yeah. Yeah, so this will be a little bit more interesting. I've got them generally organized in what I think is sort of historical order. However, it's not precise because I don't have years and all those. So on a couple of them, they're not going to be in order. Then also, there's a bit of breakdown by genre that'll cause us to move around from time to time.
But let's give people some background before you start playing. This stuff isn't going in by year.
No.
And what I mean is, like, if I don't know if they've done it yet for this... No, they have done it for this year, obviously, because that's what started this whole couple of episodes was the fact that they'd taken their entries for 2013. But it's not like a Sports Hall of Fame or the Music Hall of Fame where the event has to have lapsed 9 years before you become eligible. It's not like 2013 is covering, you know, 1965 to 69. It could come from anything. It could be the biggest hit from last year, whoever would be in there.
Yeah.
So there is no rhyme or reason too much. And again, for people who didn't hear last time, well, one, we want you to go back and listen. All this stuff, basically, us as citizens can email or call the National Record and Registry and say, I think this should be considered.
Yeah. Maybe we should collect up everybody's suggestions and we can forward them on.
Boom, we can do that.
The additional gravitas of
the Atlantic Voice podcast, now on iTunes.
We can get letterhead and we can put the whole thing together. Oh, people, we've got our business cards. Very impressive, yes.
And maybe if we send the guy one of our mugs, he may go, ooh, yeah, okay. I mean, it's not a bribe, it's just a gift.
Yep.
That's all.
So, you know, we're going to start with some of the older stuff, which people will sort of know the songs but may not know the recordings. The first one's an interesting example. You know, the song, He's Got the Whole World in His Hands, is something that we probably all sung, you know,
at some point, kids,
stuff like that. But the original version is very, very old, and probably, I think it's historic, I don't know much about it, by Marian Anderson, but its historical significance is probably in its longevity and it being a different type of thing, that it's like religious, but without being sort of like a hymn.
He's got the whole world in his hands, he's got the big round world in his hands, he's got the wide world in his hands, he's got the whole world.
And so that's in.
Yeah, so that's the actual recording that's in, you know, like, so that, you know, the song itself is... And most
wasn't that a Coca-Cola advert? That's how I
remember. Yeah, sure, sure. Well, that's the thing about, like, and probably, you know, at the time when this sort of came out, it was a much bigger deal in and of itself. It's sort of a spiritual slash thing, and probably the fact that it got onto a record in the first place and was recorded and people listened to it.
I'm going
to
give the National Recording Registry a bit of advice, because they are basically a museum, am I correct? I mean, they are there preserving all this
stuff. Yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't think you can visit it or anything like that. But.
If you put the recording of the Coca-Cola commercial in, one, you click off the song, but two, you're also paying attention to an iconic product.
Boom. Yeah,
and that saves space, doesn't it? Two things, one go, save space.
I mean, you joke a little bit,
but that makes sense.
When the first, those Coca-Cola ads came out, the ones in the 70s or so, when they started using that was like a really kind of a big deal. It was a very sort of kumbaya kind of marketing at the same time.
Exactly.
So it does have a sort of historical significance. So, you know, no objections to that, but frankly, I don't know enough about it to say, you know, were there other competitors from this genre of music that should have been better? But the fact that we're still singing it this long afterwards. Next one is, you know, keeping up with our wartime type stuff. We have another song that I don't know if you guys, if you'll recognize it. It's certainly a big American wartime song. World War I, I should have.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run.
By Nora Baines.
Hear them calling.
I think this is the recording that's actually in there. I could have messed this up, but.
Everyone for liberty. Hurry right away, no delay, stop today.
Just waiting for us to get to the chorus.
Yeah, to the chorus.
Yeah, which is using the title of the song, but. But while we're talking about it, I mean, have you heard this song before?
I have heard the song, yeah.
Okay.
Boys in line, over there, send the word over there.
Oh, wait.
That the Yanks are
point out, it's the Yanks. So I mean, it obviously is American in that it's not just a war song. It's a song about sending everybody over to the war theater in Europe in World War One.
We actually are aware of that song in Britain, except in Britain it was retitled as Over Here.
But
we have equivalent. I mean,
The
famous song from the war that everyone of a certain generation knows is from World War II was The White Cliffs of Dover. And of course, I can't remember who sung it, but and it's under, I'm not going to sit here trying to think because I know, but that's
and
another.
You didn't research it in the week off?
No. But what I'm saying is, you're right, that's a song that has social and historical significance. Mm-hmm. So the song is memorable, but also it's all about World War One.
Yeah, yeah. And you can, there's obviously quite a few little warfare songs or
Vera Lynn is the person who sang White Cliffs of Dover. So all the people back in England, you're probably thinking, oh, he didn't know what he was talking about. Yeah. I did, and I didn't have to use the computer.
Well, the intern slipped you a little piece of paper and let you know, didn't they?
That again, that's what good recording registries do.
So here's the first one where I have no idea when this is from. I took a total wild guess as to where I was slotting it historically, but I don't know how well this will play because I think of this song, and I think everybody will know this song, but they may not know a version that sounds like this by Stan Getz and Joao Gilberto. I know I definitely have this in the wrong place. Now I'm thinking about it. Because at first I was thinking Girl from Ipanema would be like war related or something like, but no, this is definitely 60s, so we have this way out of its historical context, but since we're on it, we'll talk about it here. Now, here's the first one, and this probably is a product of my ignorance. I don't really know why this one's in.
Well, because you always hear it in elevators.
Yeah.
It goes, ding, and it goes, do. And I'm not sure, and this is now my own stupidity now actually surpassing what I think I've seen in real life. At the end of the movie The Blues Brothers, Belushi and Aykroyd get into the lift at the Chicago Town Hall because they've got to get the documents.
Yeah.
And they're in the lift, and there's that great scene. There's been all this carnage outside and SWAT and cars crashing. And they get in the lift, and the camera just shows them standing there in the lift with background lift music or elevator music. And for the life of me, it should be the girl from Ipanema. It's probably not, but the stereotype is anytime you get in a elevator or if you're walking into the supermarket, it's some version of that song that's being played.
So that's a, you know, listen, cultural significance. I'm not sure it passed, but
and to be honest with you, I think that real version sucks because I like the one that you hear in the elevator more.
Well, yeah, but you know, if it's the starting recording, it's about its cultural influence.
Well, maybe,
you know,
but
that's where it came from. Without that recording, we wouldn't have it anywhere else.
All right.
So now that I've completely gone off track in terms of timing, we can kind of get back to it. I think now we're getting back into.
I wouldn't worry about that. If you're committing to listen to the Atlantic Voice podcast, your expectations for timing and stuff like that are out the window.
Next one is something that people all know well. Of course, who knows how long it takes to get to the actual chorus in this one. So, you know, we're going to have this whole lead in. You know.
It's only at that moment that I start to recognize that piece of music. First couple of bars, I had no idea what you were playing.
Yeah, you know, and it's a play, too, but I don't know. The song, I think, might have come before the play.
I think so.
It'd be nice if he started singing because this isn't really helping us out in our terms of broadcast. But
is it an instrumental or does he sing?
He's got to sing, right? We'll give him one more time around here. Wow,
I think this is the instrumental version.
Anyway, it's Ain't Misbehaving, of course. So yeah, that was some
by Fats Waller.
Excellent broadcasting right there, Bonnie.
And Fats Waller, he got in. I looked historically, he got in before Fats Domino got in. So in the battle of the guys called Fats, Waller beat Domino.
He was a more original Fats. He's probably not the first one called Fats, but he's an
older
Fats.
I'm sure there's been quite a few tubby musicians, but
Chubby Checker.
Chubby Checker.
Who got in this year.
But Chubby Checker was Fats Checker, but he changed his name to Chubby.
Yeah, he was just more short and chunky.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. That's just so. Then we now to harken back to some of our other podcasts, here's one that's in that we would have mentioned in another podcast around the holiday time. Yes. Bing Crosby, Bing White Crosby. Crispy, you know, Christmas, you know, White Crispy. So, you know, I can't remember what we said about it around the holidays.
I do remember
their
what
music,
we said.
But I'm sure.
I do remember what we said.
It'd be hard to flaw it or fault it.
Well, no, but I do remember that we actually missed it first time around. And we mentioned it in the next episode because we'd taken some heat from people for leaving out some other songs. We'd actually left out White Christmas.
Mm.
And I know that because I listened to our back issues on iTunes. So again, if you want to listen to our old episodes,
to iTunes. If you want a little Christmas in April, you know, you can listen to the Christmas songs there.
If you want your Christmas after Easter, go to iTunes for our old back episodes.
Yeah. Now, this next song, there's no real good reason for me to have included it because I didn't even know of it until recently seeing it on the HBO show Tremé, but I just think it's a cool song, so I'm putting it in there anyway. Feel free to talk over it, but... Professor Longhair, Tipitina. I mean, I didn't ever know this song until recently.
Oh, that's great. Why is it in?
That's a pretty good question. I'm guessing this probably falls in the category of Cajun Zydeco, maybe?
All right. And here's my point now. Is I feel that selection for the National Recording Registry, there's no rhyme or reason. It all just seems a bit out there. I've never heard that before. Never heard it on anything.
Good though, isn't it?
It sounds like any kind of music that I've seen on a film set in New Orleans, right? Like it sounds like it was in Runaway Jury with John Cusack, or The Big Easy with Dennis Quaid, or even JFK with Kevin Costner. All films that have New Orleans settings, and yet I don't know what this is, and yet it's in the recording register.
Yeah. Tipitina, which I think the bar in New Orleans was named after the song, not vice versa.
I didn't even know there was a bar in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
Isn't there a basketball coach called Rip Tipitino? No? Okay. Da-dum.
And it's kind of a funny voice.
Now, hold on. Now, he's singing in some sort of funny accent.
Oh, yeah.
So he's getting in under one of these other categories.
Recording?
Zydeco? Swamp?
Well, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I'm sure that's why it's in there. It's on the Cajun Zydeco Swamp category. Anyway, I've actually have that on my playlist recently because it's a cool song.
So, budding musicians out there, if you want to get... kept in memoriam, if you want to be kept for immortality, permanency, posterity, I would suggest doing something slightly off the wall.
Yeah.
Because then that gives you a chance of getting in under another category.
It's like when you have a kid who you want to get a scholarship to go to college, you got to put them into a sport that nobody else does, but
exactly.
They want to do it somewhere.
Yes.
You know, you don't want to go for the big ones, basketball and things like that. Lacrosse was always a good one for a while because...
But not now.
Nowadays, there's too many people
golf,
play lacrosse, but it used to be golf.
Tennis, bowling.
Fencing, if you find a school has a fencing
right, yeah.
type of thing. There was an article in the Post this weekend all about chess and a bunch of smaller schools. UMBC, University of
yeah.
Baltimore County, has a national championship chess team, and they have scholarships for it. So if you want to send, if you drill your kid in chess, although I think everybody is foreign who's on the team. So,
well, I want to say this: I've downloaded a terrific chess app onto my iPod. But of course, you wouldn't know that because you don't have an iPad.
I'm just amazed that you actually downloaded something to your. I mean, I get the fact that you have it, but I've not
well,
known
free.
You to be an app.
It was
user.
A free app.
There you go.
I wasn't gonna pay for it free.
It's probably not very good chess opponents there.
Well, it's a computer.
Well, I mean, you got to have like programming in there to know what's good or not.
Well, I don't know. It's a computer.
All right, then.
I don't get involved.
I don't know what year this song was, but you know, this is one that I think is sort of historically. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a big time song. It's been around forever. Patsy Cline, Crazy. Could be that this is a little later than I think it is.
I think it's like late 50s. Or is it 60s?
I'm crazy for things.
But I think this is deserving on its own artistic merit. I don't know how much
it's a great song.
It is. I mean, it's interesting. There's a number of songs.
I think it represents an era, doesn't it? That's why it gets in.
Yeah, and there's a few country songs by women that I wonder whether they get a little bit of pop just because of being sort of unique in what they're talking about and taking a role that maybe, you know, like, so here's, I'm jumping around my little list here, so it's taking me a little bit more time.
Well,
Loretta Lynn.
Yeah. That's
much
right.
A later song, but I think there's some elements of this stuff that are designed to be about, you know, sort of women blues kind of thing in a way, you know, like talking about being poor. I'm not sure. I mean, I may be completely messing this up, but I wonder whether this is back in the picture.
But that's the thing in it. And in all seriousness, if you are collecting a national registry, you do have to appeal. No, appeal is the wrong word. You do have to feel that you represent all segments of society.
That's right.
So, I mean, why is it any different? If we're going to classify music by its sort of geographical background, mm-hmm. like that one from New Orleans, then why is it any different that music that appeals or represents, you know, women breaking through as artists in a certain field, then both Patsy Cline and Loretta Lynn, they represent that, don't they?
Yeah, I think it belongs. What's interesting is I'm looking at the list now of things I put in there, and there's really not that many guys country stuff. I guess that's not true. There's definitely some old stuff. Blue Moon of Kentucky, Bill Monroe.
But these guys were the first. Cline and I keep wanting to say Sissy Spacek. Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek wasn't a movie.
They're a big part of it. Like, and so,
but they were great. Were groundbreakers. To refer back to last week's episode, they were the Neil Armstrong of country music.
I think that's got to be a big part of it. The next one
were like a female, you know, Neil Armstrong.
Probably.
And they actually sang, whereas Neil Armstrong didn't really go to the moon.
The biggest woman country singer of all time, who known for a lot of things that maybe aren't that great, but this would be like Dolly Parton doing a coat of many color with story about, you know, her mother stitching together the coat made of scraps and things like that. And so this is sort of, I think, like, interesting in that it's
did
not...
Did she get thrown down a well by her sisters?
I don't... Why is that?
What was this? Joseph and his coat of...
Oh, well, oh, yes, okay. Oh,
all right, fair enough.
Yeah, I get it.
That's the way that one went.
But this one is... I can't decide how big it is. I don't know enough about country. Maybe some folks who can email in and let us know more about whether this is really an independently a big deal of a song, or if it's unique just because they felt they wanted to put something in by Dolly Parton and they picked something that was not 9 to 5, you know, like, you know, something like that. That would be just kind of poppy schlocky.
I'm going to save people the time of emailing in. I'm going to tell you the answer right now. Because I've never heard that song. But Dolly Parton is like huge number of records sold. That's why she's in. And I think you are correct. It just... Well, you can't use 9 to 5 because that's from a movie. Well, yeah. And that breaks the movie rule. You're not allowed to use it, are you?
But I think...
That's their rule.
You know, they weren't going to do a, you know, Islands in the Stream duet with Kenny Rogers kind of thing.
Yeah,
like,
but why should he get in on her coattails?
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe that's why they picked it. I don't know enough about it. But I think it was notable. I put it on the listing here. I guess, you know, I didn't... record a lot of, or hold on to a lot of
Kenny Rogers
stuff.
Kenny Rogers should get into like the Food Hall of Fame because of Kenny Rogers chicken. Apparently that's
Kenny,
very good
Kenny
chicken.
Rogers Roasters.
Kenny Rogers Roasters chicken.
Yeah. You know, one thing that is not straight country, we're talking about bluegrass here, which is kind of a big cultural thing for America. This is the classic biggest kind of banjo song of all time, Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Sometimes people, I have heard other people with Foggy Bottom, or they said the Foggy Bottom Boys with is that John Clooney and
Joel Coltrane?
No, Clooney in the movie. George Clooney.
Oh, Brother, We're Out There.
Oh, Brother, We're Out There. They're the Soggy Bottom Boys or whatever the heck they are.
I don't know.
Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs.
But for people back in the UK, that was from the Dukes of Hazzard.
You know, I mean, bluegrass is an indigenous American music style, so
it gets in.
They gotta get a plus factor right out of the gate. They put out some bluegrass there.
But that's what. Okay, so I guess, are we ready to move into different eras now?
Yeah, so like, because I think covers my country stuff. So I was gonna, we're gonna get a little, you know, we talked about that, but then we get into 50s type things that are, you know, more pop stuff from the 50s and on, and then we'll move into the more recent pop stuff.
But when we get into recent pop stuff, I do want to say, because we spent a few minutes now listening to all his music. Some things sound vaguely familiar to my ear. You know, Patsy Cline song, I've heard that. Some of the other stuff, yeah, I had no idea what it was. But I think we've established that this stuff makes it in because it has some sort of cultural significance.
Right.
When we get to the newer music, I'm curious when they start using foreign bands, foreign to America. Because I do know the Beatles are in there, the Stones are in there. We talked about the Who and Pink Floyd. They're not American bands. So again, I am curious. There doesn't seem to be too many. There are no set parameters as to what's making it here. We can make a case for a song on a song by song basis, but if you look at them all as a whole, yeah, you know what I mean.
I know they're just culturally significant. I think cultural significance has got to be the basic touchstone of this sort of stuff,
right,
as well as aesthetic type things. Right. As I start to add things back in, so now we get back into the more rock pop type stuff, and so we have Elvis Presley's Sun Sessions as a whole, which is a whole set of recordings,
yeah,
from when
he went
by this, you know, early stuff, which includes. So we're obviously not talking about late Presley,
no,
you know, peanut butter sandwiches and rolling around,
yeah,
and drug doing and showing up at the Nixon White House and asking for a badge and all that kind of stuff. We're talking about these things, which were, everybody talks about, Elvis Presley ripping off the African-American musicians type of things, but it was, you know, culturally shifting, you know, when Elvis,
yeah,
Presley came out and did what he did, you know, it was something new on the landscape, and so there's no real way of denying that he deserves something in there.
Yeah, you just got to put something in there. I mean, you can talk, yeah, and I guess you got to do something like that because then it causes least offense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's because people are going to go, no, this one's better than that one, and you can't win. If you're the Joe at the National Registry, you can't win, so you just pick something from the early time and go, boom, this is why this is in there.
Yep. So,
because personally, I think Bossa Nova is the greatest Elvis Presley song, and I have no idea why that piece of rubbish is in there. But there you go.
So then we have a couple of other, maybe I'll hit a couple of these in succession. We'll just sort of talk over them like that, or more of these,
yep,
50s type things. Like we have,
I think,
Our Second Fats.
That is a great song, and I'm glad this is in.
I guess I'm glad it's in, but I don't know, you know, it's the kind of thing.
And you can tell by looking at me, I was ready to,
yeah,
say
it was rocking.
But I'm not
right
going to do that.
Like,
I'm not going to do that during these episodes.
But I can't decide, like, does this have that much cultural significance, or
yes,
what's the deal? Like,
it was like a huge hit.
Yeah, but did anybody change what they were doing musically or things like that as a result of that? Maybe. I mean, I just don't know the right answer.
It was huge in jukeboxes, in diners and stuff. I'm sure there are a few people that were going to have the apple pie. That song came on, they decided to have the blueberry pie.
Yep. Now, this was a pretty big deal, I do know, from just in terms of the guitar playing style and all, sort of Chuck Berry, Roll Over Beethoven.
Again, all these songs represent an era.
Yeah.
When I hear these songs, I automatically think 50s.
But I can't decide. I mean, is that...
And
there
even
could,
more
there
so.
Could be more songs. And it's the problem is that, of course, you know, we weren't there listening to these songs.
No,
so we don't
true.
Have as many in mind when we, like, we think of what would be an omission kind of thing.
But I think of 50s. I think of, like, Americana. And again, this is now as a foreigner. I hear these songs, and I have a sudden image of a country at a time in history when I hear this stuff.
Yeah, oh, sure. That's why, you know, they're all grouped together, and you got, so this,
yeah,
is... This,
so I get why they're all in.
Buddy, I really, it's the Crickets doing That'll Be the Day, and it's principally a Buddy Holly song,
yeah,
you know, basically, so... Now, the next one is on the list, and I'm not sure, you know, this definitely, you're going to know the song, but I'm not sure... You know, a known song, but again, I can't decide, like, what role it's playing here,
yeah,
to figure out how big a deal it is.
Let me tell you what role it's playing. It's an interloper. This song should not be in there.
I did think, out of the set, I was looking at this set, this seemed like if I had to cut... Like, somebody said, listen, you got five of these, and you got to cut one, this would probably be the one I'm cutting.
In the same way that if you go to iTunes now and type in podcasts, an infinite number of podcasts come up,
mm-hmm,
all right?
Yeah.
Back in the day... Records like that were coming out five every hour.
Yeah.
So why that's in there,
why?
I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it was earlier than the others than I think of, and so this was a major leader in that.
Who sung that song?
The Penguins.
Okay, I've never heard of them, but let me tell you, when I hear that song, I don't know if I've heard it before, I just know I've heard something like it.
Right, but the thing is, right...
So is that why it gets in?
Well, but here's the thing... What if that's the first one, right? Like, the thing is, if there's a whole genre of music that's inspired by the way somebody does something, you know, then you've got to say that that's what it is. I just don't know from this. And I will say, this is the one shortcoming on these recording records. When they put these things out, they're not like, we picked this because.
Oh, so they just stick it in there. There's no explanation.
I haven't seen anything that says, here's why. There's little on the National Recording Registry website. There's little bios on the music and these things, but there's nothing that sort of says this is such a big deal because, and like, so like if this one said this is a big deal because this is the first time, you know, a quartet of African-American singers sounded like this.
All right.
And everything that you think, you guys, you know, you say, oh, it sounds like everything, is it because everything sounds like it? It's like, you know, like,
I would give you that. The problem is, and I said this way back at the start of our two-part special edition,
mm-hmm.
No one's published the criteria for what gets in. So you and I can sit here. All we know is there's a couple of fellas sitting around with their Starbucks going. They're playing. The fellas hitting play on the computer. Two of them putting their hands up going yes. One's going no.
Sound recordings that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Now, what significant means, I'm not sure.
But you got to say why.
They should. I think they should say why.
And
you know,
sounding like everything else.
If nothing else, I mean, like, give it to some academics to write up something about it, some history, some music.
And I don't
want to
pick on
people.
The penguins. I think that's what they're called. One, because they're very lovable animals anyway.
Yep.
I don't want to pick on the penguins, because I'm sure that song was a big hit back in the day. But there needs to be an explanation as to, in the same way that when we listen to the Elvis song, you and I, as two people with a passing knowledge of popular music, we were quickly able to establish probably why that song was in there.
Right.
It's from his time at Sun Records, so on and so forth. These fellas, the Penguins, and that song, yeah, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, I should point out, by the way, that a lot of the things they're in, we're playing songs, but a lot of them are albums are in. You know, like, so that it isn't just that this, they're just not individual.
Oh, so the whole album goes in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it depends. They do both. Like, so when you look at the listing, if it's just the something that's in quotes, it's that song got in. When you look at it and it's the italicized thing, it's a whole song. So obviously we're not going to play a whole album. So I don't know if the Earth Angel is in for being Earth Angel. But I think, like, for example, like I mentioned, the Elvis Presley, That's All Right, is not in as a song. The album, The Sun Sessions, is in there. So it's a whole set of things. So they have, and like, you know, like Dark Side of the Moon isn't in, the song isn't in for itself.
No, but the album.
But the album is in, so it's so things like that. So here's another one, just to, I think this would be the last of the, at least the 50s guys anyway. And I think this was 50s, it could have been into early 60s. This is certainly an immortal song. You know, gets covered by people regularly, big deal kind of stuff. Roy Orbison was you know, a unique sound and style and things like that, so I think he is culturally significant.
It was also easier to put him in after you put Buddy Holly in.
Right.
Because they kind of look alike. People get them confused. It's unfair on one of them not to get in.
Well, they both wear glasses. One of them died really young, and the other one was in the Traveling Wilburys.
But they both look alike.
I don't know if they really look
Buddy
alike.
Buddy Holly got in. Oh, don't you mean Roy Orbison? No, I meant Buddy Holly. No, it's a different guy. You put them both in, and then it tidies up any confusion.
When
it's the same with Fats Domino and Fats Waller. Because then controversy breaks out.
Yeah.
How come that Fats got in and I didn't?
When you are putting up a blog post for this thing, make sure you try to find a picture where Roy. Well, no, but I mean, when you put up the post for this, put up a picture of Roy Orbison and Buddy Holly where they look alike and somebody might mistake them for each other. I'm not sure that such a picture might exist. But,
all right.
So then, you know, while we're talking about.
They look the same to me.
50s, 60s. I think we're really getting more into the 60s here, but let's go back to some women we were talking about before. In the rock area. Which, ironically enough, another song that Van Halen is covering.
Well, what was the other one?
The one we just did, Pretty Woman. Van Halen's done Pretty Woman.
Oh, have they?
Oh,
I didn't know that. I know they've done this.
Yeah. Martha Reeves, the original here, and Vandellas. I can never remember the right thing in my little Vandellas. Also covered by David Bowie and
Mick Jagger.
Yeah, that was really.
Let's hope that version hasn't made it in.
Because
then we're going down there to the National Registry ourselves.
That's right.
And demanding to see the manager have a word with someone.
Give me a copy of that. I'm taking that one back.
Yeah.
This one, there's no way this one doesn't deserve to be in there, both for sound and for content. You'll see, ironically, on my little thing, I only found this on the That's So Raven soundtrack. But
yes, I am looking at that now from a distance.
It's
and
a little
I'm thinking,
weird. I couldn't
that's
find
not
the original
Aretha.
One, but... Also in
Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers.
Yes,
so
that's
it all
right.
ties together. Here.
You with your fried chicken and you and your fried
plain white toast
or whatever it is, yeah.
But this is, I mean, listen, I don't think you can undersell this song because of the fact of being a very good song, being a cool piece, and it's all about a woman standing up and saying it.
You cannot disrespect.
A little bit of respect, at least.
Yes.
That's right. So I think that that's basically what I've got for coming from that era. You know, I don't really, you know, when we talk about songs to put in, all the songs I have that I think ought to be in that aren't in there, they're all more modern, and that's because, you know, I'm a relatively young man, you know.
That's true. I mean,
I don't know, like, when I think of that era of the 50s, 60s, that there's not really a lot of songs I can think of. Well, you know, that album should be in there because I just, well, it doesn't have the same touchstone for me.
I'm going to say this, and unfortunately for you and I, we, you know, you've just said that you are a younger than these generations,
mm-hmm.
so you have your own opinions about the broad swath of music that you listen to. Here's the issue. 40 years from now, people are going to look back at the music that we've listened to, and they're going to have the same reaction that we have to these songs. Now, what I mean by that is this. You've just played a couple, like the last five or six tracks that you've played, they all represent an era. Now, we've listened to five songs covering two eras. So, say, two or three songs per era. But there's got to be 3,000 songs for each era. The reality is, ultimately, everything from that time kind of sounds the same. So, for example, Aretha, we go, wow, that's in because that's Motown. Now, if we sat here and listed 30 different Motown songs, after a while, I'd go, yeah, these all sound the same.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to happen to our music down the line.
Well, I thought you were going after a different point, and actually, what I was going to say that I think is different when we...
No, I was actually trying to make sense there.
But yeah, I know you were trying. But what I think is going to be different is that these things, these songs in the 50s and 60s came out when you had a couple of radio stations in town. And
okay.
Everybody listened to that stuff. People didn't generally even buy that many albums, and we're now at the point, we're past the point of even everybody buying their albums and their CDs, and now it's just downloading something onto iTunes.
They download it from iTunes, and like I say, normally for like a buck or a pound. Yeah. Now, again, and I don't want to get hung up on this, but now that we're on iTunes,
we're free.
Yeah, so there you go.
Better than that. But I'm...
Roy Orbison, he's not free.
These
Plus,
songs,
he looks like Buddy Holly.
These songs, I think, had their cultural relevance in part because they were everywhere for an extended period of time, on the radio, you heard them in the car, you heard them when you were hanging around with your friends, it was the big hit, everybody listened to the big hits. When you look at what are big hits now, they're not even really that big a hit to begin with, because there are not many people buying it, but they come and they go in like a 15-minute span. Like, I don't know that everybody's going to be singing about, talking about Foster the People's Pumped Up Kicks, you know, which was a huge, huge song
last year,
as being like respect, you know, like it's just going to be, it'll sound like the era, and you'll remember it like the era, just like we remember a lot of songs from the 90s being from the era, but I'm not sure they'll hold up as being as iconic as a song like that.
Although that being said, by those same standards we've put out, by rights, Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice should make it into the National Registry. Because you can play that song now, and people know exactly what it is.
Recognizing something is not quite the same as being iconic. But we're going to get... There's quite a few songs we're going to get into that are iconic. And this one is the first of our British. I mean, nobody really even needs more than those first
guitar
notes.
That's what you
need to know, yeah. So, you know, I think the main thing about the British music that we're going to talk about, there's going to be a few more here, is its influence. Like, we had a situation where the music was bouncing back and forth across the Atlantic.
The British invasion, yeah, that's
it,
right.
It, you know, like,
yeah.
the British musicians, like The Who and Beatles were influenced by the old American, you know, blues people and things like that. It comes across, it gets... mixed around, it comes back to America. Americans now take it in, they mix it around, they turn it into something else. It really changes the direction of music back in America, after these particular Beatles come.
That is a great point, because while researching this show, and I did do some research, definitely slightly more than I normally do for the show, I was curious why these British bands were getting in. But you have now verbalized why it would be because of their effect on right. British culture. And likewise,
American culture,
I'm sorry. Yeah. If I was in charge of the British one where we're keeping all this, I would probably therefore then, Elvis Presley would make it.
Yeah, the Chuck Berry and the...
All the ones we've played, like, because you're right, it influenced the other way, we could easily claim them as our own, so to speak.
Right.
Because, yeah, I mean, that's...
So we should do that. When we sort out the British version of it, we should see if they're picking up any of this sort of stuff. So the next one, another...
If you want to go ahead and research that, we can do a whole show.
You know, another... Again, early... You know, and they definitely seem to, like, pick some of the earlier things for these things. You know, so now we have the Who, My Generation. And, like, the I Can't Get No Satisfaction is just the song that's in the registry. In this case, it's the album.
Oh, the whole album goes
in. Yeah, so, like, I think this is, you know, like... You that's know, the interesting. Mod's coming over here. Now, you know... Who knows what the standards are, but... And that's probably right, because the song itself, while the song is a big deal, this song is nowhere near as the big deal as I Can't Get No Satisfaction was. But the album may have had a more cohesive effect.
Now, that's interesting, because I do actually... I probably have some mod in me. And mm-hmm. let me digress for a brief moment. When you grew up in my generation... Everyone, when they were a teenager, you tried to classify yourself as something. Were you a rocker? Were you a teddy boy? Were you a punk? Were you a new romantic? I'd probably say that my own musical background, I am probably nearest a mod. So by rights, the Who, they're like, they should be my...
Your godfather is kind of like of your
all right, segment. So now I'm going to get to my point. You've told me that the album My Generation is in. I can't tell you what else is on that album other than that song. I have no idea. Whereas if you threw me a copy, the CD cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I could probably sit there and name five songs without looking at the album. Now, you may play some songs now that I recognize, but I didn't know they were on this album.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's a fair point. In fact, when I first saw this, because the title of the album is The Who Sings My Generation. It's not My Generation. It's like The Who Sings My Generation. Just interesting the way it's titled even.
Oh, it's concept
It was
album.
Like an introduction of them. Like, yeah. Oh, it is. We're going to tell you the name of the band in the title just so you've got it all in one place. But, you know, there's definitely obviously a bunch of them. Well, you know, I never said, and this is a digression, but
mind you, it could be a way, like, back before pre-iTunes where you could buy a single song. Back then, you're thinking, great, I've got to buy the whole album now, and you know, I only like that song.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, because, of course, singles would have been a bigger deal leading up to
singles
that. With the Beatles, even with Elvis Presley, that, you know, is much more likely to buy your local 45 single. And this may be in there in part because it was... an album, you know, like, it's not quite a concept album. Obviously, Who gets into concept albums later on, but it is a notion of a cohesive statement as an album. Beatles had already started doing that, I guess, at that point, but it is sort of interesting.
But my generation is what, 63, 64? Does it say there?
Yeah.
Well, again, it's no good because the National Registry just sticks it in there. Doesn't tell you anything.
No, they do tell you the year in this thing, but I don't know which, because I don't know which. Oh, here it is. 1966.
Then that is, like, I always think of, and again, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, I always think of Sgt. Pepper's as being the Beatles' first sort of concept-type album where it's all linked together and there's something going on.
Mm-hmm.
This predates that. 67 was Sgt. Pepper.
And of course,
if I'm right, Sgt. Pepper is 67. And that's the first time, that's one of the first albums where there is this notion that there is, it's more than just a collection of songs.
Yeah. I should have mentioned, by the way, you know, as we said during the Christmas broadcast about the music, you can't get the Beatles anywhere online where you can play them. Like, you could buy it on iTunes and do this, but I can't go to the online services I use and get any Beatles because they don't allow their rights on.
Well, you
like,
can click on iTunes and just get, like, the free 30 seconds.
That's true. You could
you
do it that
it.
Way. I so do some, do some people do that kind of version of the broadcast. But so I don't have that, but obviously the Beatles album that's in is the one, Sgt. Pepper's, and you know, any number of different albums could be in, you know, as well. You know, you could have Rubber Soul or Revolver or White Album, all of which are in like Rolling Stone's top 10 albums of all time, you know. But so we're not going to actually play any Beatles.
Well, I'm now going to throw you a softball. You did indicate to me pre-show that in your very voluminous research that you've done for this show, that basically it looked a little bit like there seemed to be some lazy relationship between the National Recording Registry and Rolling Stone's Top 500.
Yeah, well, I can't...
Please expand on that.
Well, so, like, if you go to Rolling Stone's magazine, they have... It's very annoyingly set up, but they have top 500 albums of all time, top 500 singles, top 5... Maybe it's only top 100 guitarists or things like that. And it's set up so that you have to click on each one individually to see what's there and all that sort of stuff. And when I was trying to think of, you know, remind myself of albums that maybe should be there, I'm looking at this list, and as I'm going down, I'm like, they're all lining up with the National Historic Registry albums in a large part. And so I'm like, I'm going to guess that it's more like, I mean, obviously, there's a commonality in the evaluations, so they can come to the same conclusions, but it did seem awfully convenient that a lot of these things were flat out overlapping. And I just wonder whether this guy, when he was in doubt, now this Rolling Stone thing came out in 2012, so
this is what I believe is going on down there at the National Recording Registry, because I find it highly unlikely that someone who really likes Casey at the Bat that we covered last week, that poem that sounded like Monty Python albums, yeah, that they're also heavily into Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Because as someone who owns Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, I thought that other poem was a load of cobblers. This is what I think has occurred.
Cobblers.
Are people
that
down...
A load of cobblers.
That's probably a phrase that's recorded in the British Library, where they record accents and phrases for posterity. Now, I think what's happening down there is the old boys that are working down here at the old Library of Congress, like anything, they've moved into a area that's really not their expertise. Yeah. So what do? You go online, you go to the Rolling Stone website, and then you just start picking stuff from there.
On the other hand, Rolling Stone is hardly the most sophisticated tastemakers anymore. It would not surprise me
if
at all.
You're
they
working,
if they were borrowing back, and their list came out in 2012, so I'm not sure that that really the registry people could have done that. But there could be some cahoots there.
I'm sure there is there.
So here's a good example,
actually. It's the same way that when I need to know something, I go to Wikipedia. It's the same as that.
So, you know, we were just talking about, like, the influence back and forth. So now here's a band that is admittedly was heavily influenced or competing, at least one of the members of the band, Brian Wilson, was heavily into competing with the Beatles because of how popular they were.
The
music doesn't sound anything like the British music. It's definitely American-style music with this beach sound and things like that. But this is off of Pet Sounds, and Pet Sounds is... like the great Beach Boys concept album that came out, that was a whole set of stories in there and things like that. And so you can see maybe some of the concept album idea of Sgt. Pepper is coming back through Pet Sounds, and now the Americans are now not, they're not imitating the music. This is what I think is interesting. It's new art influenced by prior art kind of thing.
Yeah, they're taking an idea.
Yeah.
So they're taking the concept.
Only about my favorite album of all time.
That is, I know. You always find a way to
I gotta
slip them in
some Beach. Well, in this case, it was convenient because they're in the registry. We then, let's see, what else have we got here? I don't know where to fit a couple of these in here, but like, so you mentioned Paul Simon, right?
Oh,
so,
crying out loud.
So Paul Simon goes in. We're going to jump around a little bit on Paul Simon here because this gets in, which I believe deserves to be in.
Darkness, my old friend.
So Simon and Garfunkel, Sounds of Silence. I mean, here's a major song, you know, and also had a big connection into the movies.
But this is how they get about the non-movie rule. Because they wrote it for the movie. They did that whole soundtrack. But they release it separately as an album. And you'll notice the cut you've just played starts with like live audience applause.
Yeah,
that's how they get around getting that in.
Is that right? They wrote it for the movie, or is it vice versa? The movie grabbed it after they wrote
it. No, because they did the whole.
Movie, of course, being The Graduate for anybody. And if you haven't seen The Graduate, then you're not a fan of film. You need to go see it, whether you like it or not, which I think most of you will. It's got some weird things to it, but it's a major film in terms of history, movie making. So.
No, they did the soundtrack for the whole film.
Yeah, but I didn't know which order it came, whether it was their stuff put into it or whether they recorded for it. I think you're right. I guess you're right.
I think that was it. They did it, and then it became a hit, and then it, you know, because I guess the relationship back in the day, it was very different. Like now people do songs for movies because it goes in the film, You can play it on the video. You can use it in the marketing. Everyone's making money. I think back then it was very different. It was like, hey, will you do music for my film?
Yeah.
And so it wasn't some sort of tie-in.
We're going to jump around just so we can trash on Paul Simon a little bit, who's actually somebody I like, but because the other thing that's in...
Although in his defense, he's in there as Simon and Garfunkel.
Okay. So this is... Admittedly, I picked one of the songs that I find the more annoying songs on Graceland.
Oh, really?
So the album Graceland's
that
in
it. That doesn't annoy me at all. A man walks down the street,
he says, why am I soft? This was a big deal when it came out at the time.
Played a lot on MTV.
Yeah. I want a shot of redemption. It's not Sound of Silence where I'm listening to it today. This comes on the radio today. I am changing the channel.
I'm hitting scan. That's right.
You know, I guess maybe it's got a historical significance. But here is an interesting thing about this Paul Simon piece, right? This album, Graceland, got in like 3 or 4 years before Sounds of Silence. So, like,
and that's
you're
looking, that is nonsense.
See, that's the first sort of blatantly like, yes, somebody was messing up here, because how could you, if you're evaluating Paul Simon, you're like, oh, what thing should I put in here? I'm going to go with Graceland before you go with Sounds of Silence.
That's
you got
what
it
I'm
all
saying.
Backwards.
My biggest thing, as you look for more music to play, my biggest concern with this National Recording Registry. And again, I'll admit, my research only went to a couple of internet searches and then the Wikipedia pages that you gave me. So I could easily stand corrected here. No one's really published the criteria for how and why these things are getting in. If I'm getting into a sports hall of fame, it's because I've scored more goals or played more games or thrown more touchdowns than the next fella.
Yeah, I'm not listening to this music anymore.
I don't want it. But again, but you've just said... Paul Simon's got in for Graceland before Sounds of Silence?
Well, so we're saying that's wrong, but I don't need to hear
about
this.
No, I'm not saying it's wrong.
I'm
saying it's fixed. That's what I'm saying. It's fixed.
Who's making the money on this one? All right, so I'm going to jump to some things because otherwise...
Well, not us, because when you download Atlantic Voice, we don't charge you.
You know, here, iconic, can't deny that, you know, Jimi Hendrix has got cultural significance,
oh, yeah,
all of it. So we're going to have it. And actually, here's another one where went to Britain when he didn't succeed here initially, made his bones over Britain, comes back with all this. You look at the album cover, it looks like it came out of the Beatles album kind of thing. And as long as we're hitting our actually, here's another one that's of older times. Freewheeling Bob Dylan, the whole album is in there. This is things in there. Bob Dylan's a weird one for me because I appreciate him more than I enjoy him. And I'm not talking about the sort of stereotype of him mumbling. I mean, you can hear these. You know, you can hear him sing here. Clearly well done. And yet I don't typically sit down and listen to an album by him.
I will say this for Bob Dylan, though. And this is an interesting thing, and I mean this in all seriousness. Because I'm now looking at you playing this on your computer, and I can see that album cover again. The images of Bob Dylan are more iconic than the music of Bob Dylan. You've just said you don't listen to Bob Dylan. No, but I'm going to tell you something. No, I mean it seriously now. That album cover, I look at that and I go, yeah, that tells me something. There's the famous video of him with the cards.
Yeah, the cards, sure. But there's no way that this is not bigger than his music. His music is definitely bigger than that.
I didn't mean that, but what I mean is...
It's pretty big. I mean, the image... I mean, listen, that's what they say about Bob Dylan. It's half image. You know, that's the thing is how he made his bones is this you know, mysterious wayfaring...
No, but I'm going to make a serious point, because I'm not a Bob Dylan fan, so I don't know his songs. You could play me something and go, this is Bob Dylan, and I'm going to go, I've never heard that before. But you could show me the album cover from some song that I've never heard before, and I'm going to go, oh, yeah, that seems familiar. That's my only point. That's my serious point.
Yeah, all right.
Now, that's all I'm saying. Dylan, there is something about his presence. And again, when he wears those glasses, he looks like Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison as well when he puts those black glasses on. All I'm saying, there's something about his presence that is... That surpasses his music.
You have some thing where, like, you know, somebody puts on a pair of glasses, they suddenly look like everybody else.
Well, you do. Michael Caine wore those glasses back in the 60s. He looks like Buddy Holly, but with blonde hair.
Yeah. So now we start to move in now. So we're emerging out of the 60s, heading into the 70s, and so we've got the...
We need to move along, because we've been rolling for a while.
We're going to have to do a part three. We've got the Allman Brothers. Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore, which was a big album, you know.
Yeah.
I think I can't argue with that. We've got Marvin Gaye, What's Going On.
Okay.
I mean, which, by the way, this is one of these things that has, when you get the recording, has this really annoying intro of everybody talking before they get to the actual song. Brother, brother, brother. Now, here's something I will listen to if it comes on. And obviously, this has both political significance and everything. Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life is in. I couldn't decide what song to put on. There's no song that jumped out. And this is another annoying intro. Like, because I don't really think of this song as being a big deal, but this might be the biggest hit off of Songs in the Key of Life.
Well, I do think this song is a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know if it's in and of itself. It's a big hit, but I don't know if it's a big deal in terms of cultural significance.
Well, but this is my point then. For Stevie Wonder, he's
not as important as this one, though. Do not mess with Parliament. Pre-Funkadelic, mind you, but...
I need to go and download this song later.
Yeah.
Let me say this about Stevie Wonder. All right? And no, I'm not going to say he gets his glasses at the same place as Buddy.
Well, would you say they look the same if they did?
I think they wore the same style of glasses back then. Stevie Wonder's got to be in there somewhere, right? He's got to be in there.
Yeah.
You can't have one of these recording registries and go, Stevie Wonder's not getting it. But again, you can't isolate one, even though that last song's a big hit. You could have six different people in the room, Stevie Wonder fans, and they would argue for hours about what their best favorite Stevie Wonder song, best album, etc., etc. Here's the bottom line. You've got to have him in there somewhere, so you pick that album. Boom, and he's in. It's more important than he's in, because Stevie Wonder stands for something rather than that's the greatest R&B song.
The thing is,
if
you're having that much trouble, if you're having that much trouble picking a song or album for him, maybe you're wrong about that first conclusion. You know,
well, no, but you can make an argument for the Beatles. Well, the Beatles are going to be in there.
So, but
which song do you put in? Which album do you put in?
They put in Sergeant Pepper. I think that's a fair choice.
Yeah, but you easily could have picked, you know, the White Album or Let It Be should be the song that's in there. But what I'm saying is it doesn't matter. We've got them in.
They're a half step beyond.
It's a Hall of Fame. They're in.
What do we got here? We got this one, which would be, you know, Carole King Tapestry. The whole album's in. And I know there are some family members of the Atlantic Voice who stand by this as a major, major album. It's not something I own.
Well, you know, they think that song's about you.
What's it?
wasn't that Carole King?
No.
Who sings that?
That's,
I think that song is about you,
don't Carly Simon.
Oh. Well, that's what I'm saying. They all represent the same thing.
Are they wearing the same glasses? Is that why you thought they were the same?
No, but they're all wearing flared jeans.
Now, Carole King and James Taylor and Jackson Brown and all that, they come from a whole segment of the 70s singer-songwriters, which was pretty revolutionary.
And I sang right there for about 3 seconds.
That's kind of scary.
Oh.
So here's another one that, I don't know, you know, how people are going to feel about the band. The band's original album, The Band, is in there. I actually think The Last Waltz should be in there because that's the one with the movie that's really even better than stuff. But this, of course, The Band was a big deal in terms of influencing music at the time of this sort of Americanifying the music again and bringing in elements of country into rock kind of thing. But then, you know, listen, if we're going to go icons here, it's hard to beat this one. 1975. I mean, it's kind of hard to think about this being from 1975 because this song, like, just feels like you could put it out today and people be fired up about it. And actually, the whole album, the Born to Run album is in there.
But that's what I'm saying. Springsteen, again, you could argue until 2 in the morning what should be in there. Some people are going to, younger people are going to tell you, well, the epitome of Springsteen is Born in the USA. Some people are going to say that. But what I'm saying is it doesn't really matter. He's in. Yeah, this is the one that's in there, but he's
well, in. I mean, I think you can make an easy case of that sort of stuff. We then sort of headed into some things that, you know, is this necessarily like a big... It's a big deal in terms of a symbolic piece of an era. Donna Summer, I Feel Love. So this is, I mean, this is like a piece of disco, real one, not the movie version that we talk about, but I don't know if I'd pick it. I don't know.
Well, and this is, and now, I mean, I like disco in a way that you get older and it's 40 years old and it comes on and you know it. It's like, it's a bit like ABBA. in that you'll buy the greatest hits album and you suddenly realize you know all these songs.
Yeah.
Is it the be-all and end-all? I'm not sure. But here's my issue. If I agree with you that Donna Summer, you're not sure that should be in there, but it represents an era. Okay, fair enough. It's in. In the vote, in the article that we saw a couple of weeks ago that prompted these whole couple of episodes we're doing, the Bee Gees and the set, obviously the Bee Gees are part of that Saturday Night Fever album.
Right.
That's getting in.
Well, keep in mind, it wasn't a...
I think that's an album like an ABBA that I know the songs, but I'm not going to sit here and try and tell anyone, yeah, you know, if you're on your desert island, that needs to be one of them. We are now double dipping, or not we, they are double dipping by throwing in all kinds of music that's probably not that great, but it represents an era.
Well, you know, like that's
here's my
opinion,
point.
So you don't like it either?
I mean, I'm not sure.
Well, you're going to have to take a stand, I think.
Pro or con?
Up, thumbs up or thumbs down on I Feel Love?
My answer is no.
All right, then.
There is room for Donna Summer or Saturday Night Fever, not both. You can't all be in there because you represent disco. If we're doing it just because it represents something, then you pick one representative and that's the end of it. You're not sending 25 guys to the United Nations. You're sending one guy to represent your country. So when you're sitting there next to Bahrain and Belize, it's 1-1-1-1. America don't get to send 40 ambassadors. They just send one.
Well, they're putting them
and
in
that's
every
the same
year,
as everyone else in the United Nations. So here's the thing now. I don't think that Donna Summer song is the world's greatest song, but it represents an era. So it's in. Saturday Night Fever doesn't get to go. It can't make the same claim.
Well, no, but Saturday Night Fever is a movie.
Disco's already being represented.
It's a movie soundtrack. Soundtrack's a whole separate category, you know, so... So, quite a few things more to cover.
Then you know what we're going to do?
We're going to do a bonus episode. We're going to break this up again.
We'll break this up again. We'll do a bonus episode. Is there something you want to play this episode out on?
Well, you know, I think.
Do it.
We have to we stick with what we came with.
You have been listening to the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us at atlanticvoice.net, email us atlanticvoice@gmail.com, or follow us on Twitter @Atlantic_voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.